encompass brain injury resulting in decreased IQ, injury to the reproductive organs resulting in decreased fertility when today's child becomes tomorrow's adult, and damage to the liver, which interferes with cholesterol metabolism and increases risk for obesity, for diabetes, for heart disease, and stroke.
Dr. Landrigan, we just have 30 seconds. Plastics and climate change are both born of the fossil fuel industry. Talk about how they're connected.
Well, they both originate from fossil fuels, and the other connection is that plastic production is energy intensive. It liberates 2.4 gigatons of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere every year. That's more CO2 than comes out of Brazil or Russia.
And finally, what you're hoping to come out of the Lancet report in 20 seconds, if you would.
We need two big things out of the negotiations in Geneva. Firstly, a cap on global plastic production because the current trend is not sustainable. And secondly, strict regulation of the more than 16,000 chemicals in plastics, which currently are responsible for most of plastics' known hazards to human health.
I want to thank you for being with us, Dr. Philip Landrigan, Director of the Global Observatory on Planetary Health at Boston College. We'll link to your piece in the Lancet Countdown on Health and Plastics. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our website's democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from the Neocony Coast Art and Music Cultural Foundation, presenting Rockaway Beach Music Festival and All Ages Music and Arts Festival in Rockaway Beach on August 16th and 17th. The event will feature live music, local food, art exhibits, and local craft vendors. More info at rbmusicfest.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council is looking at a multi-million dollar settlement this afternoon for the family of the man killed by Portland police. Portland and Multnomah County look at strengthening safety at the Central Library after a deadly shooting, and how changing abortion laws are affecting women and doctors in the Pacific Northwest. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 7th, 2025. I'm Annette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. On November 19th, 2022, Portland police killed a local man. Today, the Portland City Council is discussing a settlement of more than $3 million to his family. KBOO's Hannah Francis has the story.
Today, City Council voted to pay a settlement of over $3 million to the family of Emmanuel Manny Clark Johnson, a man wrongfully killed by the Portland police. In November of 2022, Clark Johnson was shot in the back by an officer and left lying on the ground in pain for almost 30 minutes before receiving medical attention. He died in the hospital 5 days later. Clark Johnson's family sued the city of Portland and the officer who shot him. The lawsuit says that Clark Johnson was wrongly and unreasonably believed to be an attempted robbery suspect. The police account of what happened that night is different from the lawsuit's account. The police say that Clark Johnson was driving a car that matched the description of a suspect vehicle involved in a robbery. Police report that they made a traffic stop when the car was driving erratically. They pulled him over, he tried to escape, and they shot him. The lawsuit's account says that Clark Johnson was standing next to his non-running car when the police conducted their quote-unquote stop. Clark Johnson ran away from them. He was unarmed and not threatening the officers. And then he was shot in the back with an AR-15 rifle. The lawsuit also says that the robber description that the police were given described the suspects as a group of three or four white men driving a sedan. Clark Johnson was black. It has been confirmed that no one in or near Clark Johnson's car was involved in the robbery. The lawsuit outlines several other instances when Portland police have shot someone and failed to get them medical attention in a timely manner. City Council voted to deliver the settlement just an hour ago to Manny's family. Councillor Canal and Pirtle Guinea had in-depth comments.
I'm not after discipline. I'm after change. I'm after things like this not happening in the future. My mom was a law enforcement officer, and I was taught from a very early age some very specific standards around weapon use. And one of those was that you don't shoot unless you intend to and are willing to kill someone. And in this case, we have two things that happened from my perspective. We have somebody who was killed because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, who was not involved in the police activity of that night. But we also have a set of policies that say that it is okay to kill someone for a robbery. And I struggle to sit with that policy. And I struggle even more to sit with the fact that that policy was applied to Manny for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, not even involved.
The one that I wanted to highlight from the point that was made by a couple colleagues is what was brought up in the testimony, that it's also the use of an AR-15 as a de-escalation technique. This is a haunting statement for me because the officer's actions were described in Damon Lamar Johnson's death in June as, quote, de-escalating him, as if de-escalation is something we impose on someone instead of a mutual evolution of an incident to a more peaceful condition and place. Put simply, you cannot de-escalate someone with an AR-15.
For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Hannah Francis.
A call for safety after a deadly shooting outside a place that many say should be safe, the Central Library in Portland. On July 1st, surveillance video showed Douglas Ivers and Hassan Musay inside the library on Southwest 10th Avenue and Yamhill Street. Shortly before the shooting outside, which killed Ivers, police arrested Musay. Since then, Multnomah County and Portland leaders have talked about the need to increase security and safety in the area. Today, library and police representatives met with the Multnomah County commissioners, laying out a plan for making the area safer. Annie Lewis is the director of libraries for Multnomah County.
We are here today to brief the board and our community on safety and security in and around Central Library. Today's briefing will include an overview of the changes made to date, the work underway to analyze additional enhanced safety measures, and our next steps. This is a collaborative effort, as the chair noted, between the county, the library, the city, workplace security, and members within the city of Portland Police Bureau. Today we'll be sharing a briefing on our progress to date on researching and evaluating added enhanced safety and security measures, and I expect to have a full report to the board in September with a complete analysis of these options. As we think about the enhanced security measures at Central Library and the options for keeping our libraries as safe as possible, the library is really one of the last truly public spaces where everyone is welcome. I hold this dear to my heart in the way that I lead and provide services here at our library system. Our community loves Multnomah County Library. I think you all know that we are one of the busiest libraries in the nation. And our Central Library is no exception. Central Library has an annual door count of about 415,000 people, or that translates into about over 1,100 people per day. In FY25, we held 425 programs, and we're also one of the largest Wi-Fi providers in the city, with close to 319,000 public Wi-Fi sessions just at Central Library. Per year, not day. That would be a very high number.
We're busy, but we're not that busy.
As I shared, the library being one of the last truly public spaces where everyone is welcome, we must balance our duty to provide people with the rights to access library services with a commitment to equitable and inclusive services and the need to ensure libraries are safe spaces for all. There are tensions between these priorities and their trade-offs that we must consider in any effort to enhance security measures. Multnomah County, library staff, community members, Portland police, and the City of Portland are concerned about the security of Central Library due to incidents involving weapons, as well as drug use and other illegal activity that is happening at our library. The library and workplace security are working together to improve the safety and security of staff and patrons at Central Library. And I'm really happy that Robert is here today representing Portland Police to be able to also speak to Portland Police's commitment to working collaboratively together with us.
Thank you, Annie. One of the things that Chief Day asked me to relay to the board is that we are committed to being a part of the process. We're really pleased to see the operations group formed. We think that'll be a place for a lot of productive conversations to happen. Also, Commander Hughes at Central Precinct has been very much involved in the conversation discussion, done a lot of work, Chair, with you, obviously, in the county on deflections. So you have a commitment from Portland Police Bureau to be a partner in this, to continue to work in this working group, to continue to take action that increases safety at the library.
Our goals in this work are to reduce the volume of incidents that involve physical or emotional harm, reduce the risk of unauthorized weapons in our library facilities, and to increase the feeling of safety among Central Library staff and patrons. For library staff to feel safer, we also need to gather and apply their input about new safety measures. As we know, the challenges we face within and around Central Library are reflective of broader systemic issues. The issues that we face require partnership with our safety partners, and they also require effort and resources from the City of Portland, Multnomah County, and from the Portland Police Bureau. To ensure we're working together towards our common goals, we've formed a joint operations team that has leadership from each of our agencies. This team includes leadership from the county, city, and Portland Police Bureau. We are meeting every other week, and we have very frequent contact in between those meetings. We are working together on a list of action items that we are reviewing and implementing over the summer and into the fall. These action items include both short-term actions that are immediately implementable, as well as longer-term actions that require review and analysis. One of the action items is developing a regular report to track the impact of these additional safety measures. And our team is currently discussing the baseline data that we will utilize to help measure those improvements. We've also heard concerns from our business community, particularly businesses in and around Central Library downtown. We've connected so far with 18 business owners and dropped off our contact information, had conversations with businesses who have expressed concerns about the safety issues they encounter downtown. In those conversations, we've heard broad concerns around the local economy, around drug use and houselessness, and general concerns about safety in the downtown area. We definitely heard a universal voice that businesses want a thriving downtown, and so do we. We're committed to working together with them towards that goal. I'm also working on a system to be able to send regular updates to our business partners. Following the deadly shooting that occurred on July 1st on the corner of Southwest 10th and Yamhill, the library immediately began a review of our internal security measures.
And that was Multnomah County's library director. In the Pacific Northwest, women, lawmakers, and doctors are struggling with tough decisions with the real-life impact of restrictive abortion laws. Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray gathered women who've dealt with the extreme situations as a result and doctors who treated them for a panel discussion. Here's part of that talk.
I'm going to start with Kayla Smith, who I've known for a while. Is an amazing person who's got the courage to share what happened to her, and it's important for all of you to know. So I'll start with you, Kayla.
Thank you. In the fall of 2022, my husband and I found out we were pregnant again with our second child, and this was just after Roe was overturned. And so obviously there was fear with that, but the only thing that we were concerned about was preeclampsia, because that's what I had dealt with before in my prior pregnancy. And then the day after the trigger law went into effect to ban abortion in the state of Idaho, we found out that our son had several fatal fetal anomalies. And so our maternal fetal medicine specialist shared with us that unfortunately, if we wanted to end this very wanted pregnancy, that she would no longer be able to help us in the state of Idaho. So we found ourselves in this place where we didn't know what we were going to do, because the risk of me staying pregnant could impact my life if I were to develop preeclampsia again, which was very likely. So we had to take out a $16,000 personal loan to drive 8 hours from Idaho to the University of Washington, where I received an induction, and we were able to meet our son. And it was the most tragic thing we ever had to deal with, to make that decision, but then to also be forced to flee our state, to have to go somewhere else to get care that we should have gotten, was just devastating. Also the financial impact of that as well. And in that moment, like, I did not want an abortion, but I needed one. And I felt like my providers were not able to give me that standard of care that should be available to everyone. So now at this point, my family has moved to Washington. I have had another baby that we welcomed in 2023, and she's doing really well. We love it here. I did end up getting preeclampsia with her, so I was very thankful to be in a state where I knew that if my life was at risk, that not only would I be taken care of, but they would also try to take care of my baby as well. These abortion bans are not saving lives. They're actually putting more lives at risk, right? We know that cutting Medicaid is going to increase this. So over half of women who seek abortion care live under the poverty line. Getting an abortion now is a privilege, which it should not be, because it is health care that should be readily available to everyone who needs or chooses. Choosing to grow your family is a really nuanced thing, but so is abortion care. And so I'm thankful for physicians who are willing to talk about how Trump's cuts and the funding to abortion bans are impacting women and women's health care.
Dr. Remy.
I want to talk about how this legislation is an intentional and sweeping divestment from vulnerable and marginalized communities, all in order to provide tax cuts to the ultra-wealthy and large corporations that don't need it. I worry that this legislation not only will prove detrimental to abortion access and care, but also to reproductive health in general. So with the cuts to Medicaid, the ACA, and CHIP, we are looking at millions of people losing their health insurance. And this also blocks lawfully here immigrants from accessing Medicaid at all. So we are looking at a large portion of people who will no longer have access to basic medical insurance. And it doesn't stop there. There's going to be higher copays and higher premiums. So for those who think that because they are not on public insurance, they don't have to worry about this, that's not true, because private insurance will also be affected by this. And we will be in a situation, once again, as before Obamacare, where people are deciding between rent, food, and health care. And I can tell you which one is going to get cut in that scenario. This will also lead to massive cuts and lack of access to basic hospital care throughout the country and the state, particularly in rural areas. Also, it's expected that maybe about 140 labor and delivery units, mostly in rural areas, will be shut down because of this legislation. That means you are leaving people away from care, unable to access care, having to travel long distances to care, and basically threatening people's lives. Because when you have to travel long distances to care, that means if you are in trouble, you may not get care in time. In addition, it keeps going, Medicaid insurance covers nearly half of the births in this country, nearly half. By slashing that, you are slashing the ability for many people to seek pregnancy care. This also means seeking care in pregnancy for basic medical conditions that require treatment and monitoring during pregnancy. You are pushing people to only come to care when they absolutely need it, when they are critical, when they will need more care and more invasive care, and where people will die, because they do not have the care that they require throughout their pregnancy to have healthy pregnancies. You're also denying people the access to have abortion care paid for by their insurance. If they don't have Medicaid insurance, they don't have the financial means to pay for abortion care, meaning you are forcing people to carry pregnancies that are not desired simply because they do not have the financial wherewithal to pay for it. Meanwhile, billionaires get tax cuts. That is simply egregious and unacceptable that we are playing with people's lives to provide billionaires with more billions of dollars. And overall, we are already struggling, continuing to struggle with a maternal mortality rate that disproportionately affects Black and Indigenous people. This will only make that worse. It'll make it worse for Black and Indigenous people and for everyone in general. We are looking at a huge fallback from this that will affect pregnant people for time to come, and I really worry about the long-term effects that this will have, particularly our most vulnerable communities, our lesbian, gay, gender non-conforming, transgender communities, our Black, Latinx communities, and our immigrant communities. They will suffer the most, as they have always suffered the most. They will be disproportionately affected. And lastly, I want to touch on something that I don't think always gets connected to healthcare or the drawbacks in healthcare this legislation will provide. The graduate student loan cap that blocks professional learners from seeking more than $200,000 to pay for professional school will cause a worsening of the already present physician and provider shortage. You're basically only allowing people who have the funds to shell out $400,000 to pay for their education, or forcing people to take on predatory loans that will have a negative impact on their careers and on their lives. And that lack of physicians will lead to longer wait times in the emergency rooms, longer wait times to see the doctor. When you want to see the doctor, appointments are already being booked out for months at a time because there are not enough providers to take care of people. And it will devastatingly affect the diversity of our medical workforce, which we know is not good for patients, it's not good for the medical system, and it's not good for hospital systems. So this legislation deprives people of their access to healthcare. It deprives people of their choice in wanting to start a family, not wanting to start a family, and being able to start a family in a safe and healthy way. And it blocks people from their basic human right to receive medical care. This legislation will lead to many preventable deaths, and it's just not acceptable.
State Representative Jeff Helfrich, whose district includes the Rowena fire-ravaged Hood River area, worries that red tape and restrictions will keep some people from rebuilding.
To sit there and walk through the roads that I knew where my wife's surrogate grandmother lived at, and looking at what her single wide trailer was, and it was a molten thing of aluminum. Literally, there was just, it looked like a vat of aluminum out of the smelter had poured out and just went down the ground. And so it was just devastating. And it was saddened. I knew some of the people that were there, the homes were gone. But what was remarkable to me was there was homes that didn't get touched. And the thing of it is when you live in the gorge, we know it's windy. And there are different layers of bureaucracy. And you always hear people talking about the Tri-County area, Multnomah County, Washington County, and Clackamas County. Then they are overlaid with Metro, which is another just nightmare of laws and governing bodies. Well, we kind of have that here too with the Columbia Gorge in the National Scenic Area. And I love the place we live. It's beautiful. It's stayed this way because of the National Scenic Area Act, but it has also hamstrung some things. And you've had people that lived there for 30, 40 years prior to the National Scenic Area Act. And my concern is that they will not be able to afford to rebuild with the existing structure they had because of the amount of regulations that are going to be overlaid on them. When it came to the Columbia Gorge Commission and what it takes to build a house outside of an urban growth boundary of a city, because Rowena is not technically a city, it's just an area. And so my concern is because of the new regulations and because of the fire hardening, that there is going to be a lot of conflict. And when I say the conflict is within the rulemaking and how they're going to build these houses, in order to build a home in the National Scenic Area and to have it fire hardened, they recommend metal roofs. And it takes a special coating on a metal roof to avoid the sun from reflecting off of it and maybe getting in your eyes for that 2 or 3 seconds as you turn the corner. They want a special coating on it, and thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars. And so you can't cut these trees down for this, or you have to have a certain appearance when it comes to the aesthetics of what the outside looks like with plants and the house color and the building materials and all that. And so my hope is that they're able to rebuild what they had before to the same standard there and be able to have some upgrades and get that done. But what a lot of people don't understand is there's two water treatment facilities there that get water to these places, and they're unable to do it because the groundwater is contaminated. And so there's infrastructure dollars that we're going to have to be able to get to Wasco County and their water department, the One Water Agency out there, to get them on, get those communities on board with water, the potable water that they can use because of the contamination. And there's a lot of these older single wides that were there, manufactured homes that did have asbestos in them. We know they did because they were built in the 60s and 70s. That was just part of the construction. And so those are those concerns and worries. The governor's office is going to be able to give X amount of dollars for recovery efforts, but now we have to, you guys are requesting so we can go to the e-board, the emergency board, and sit and take that case to the emergency board and use those dollars that are set aside for emergencies to help offset those costs, the recovery efforts with Rowena.
And again, that was Oregon State Representative Jeff Helfridge, who represents the Hood River area. There's new research showing U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement is not just targeting immigrants with criminal records during mass arrests. And as Frieda Ross reports, it also shows that deportations negatively impact the economy.
The Immigration Research Initiative's report finds that when arrests rose from January to May this year, many of those detained lacked a criminal record. Although President Donald Trump campaigned to deport immigrants who committed heinous crimes, report co-author Chloe East says that's not who's being arrested.
The majority who are currently impacted have no criminal conviction, and instead, the only potential violation they have is a civil violation of not complying with immigration law.
The Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, or TRAC, is a research-focused nonprofit. It supports these findings with data showing more than 70% of people detained had no criminal record. TRAC's research includes data showing immigrants arrested during past mass deportations had at least minor criminal convictions. Another report from the University of Pennsylvania claims mass deportations may have drastic economic consequences, depleting workforce and shrinking wages. He says just the fear of mass arrests creates major challenges to the economy.
Immigrants are much more fearful about leaving their home when they hear about these types of raids, so they often don't go to work or don't go to work as frequently as they would have otherwise, which makes it really hard for businesses to continue to function.
I'm Frieda Ross.
Should D.C. be its own state? More on that in today's edition of 2025 Talks.
As long as we have limited home rule in this city, we're always vulnerable to the whims of the Congress or a president.
Washington Mayor Muriel Bowser says D.C. residents won't have the full rights of American citizens until the nation's capital becomes the 51st state. President Donald Trump is again threatening to take over the city after a former federal employee was injured in an attempted carjacking. He says liberal policies have led to more violent crime, but incidents are down a quarter in the last year to the lowest rate in decades. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick says red states deserve more representation in Congress and that Texas Republicans will do, quote, whatever it takes to pass a new redistricting map.
We're going to get it done. There's nothing they can do to stop us. And I challenge them, come back and do the right thing. Don't run and hide because you've lost touch with the voters.
More than 50 Democrats left the state to deny House Republicans a quorum, the minimum number to conduct business. Officials are threatening penalties. Patrick says the Texas Senate will try to move ahead on redistricting next week. A new report found more than 500 cases of human rights abuses at ICE detention centers nationwide. Democratic Senator John Ossoff of Georgia says an investigation by his office found mistreatment of children and pregnant women, sexual abuse, and denial of legal representation. Congressional Republicans back home for summer recess are facing constituents angry over the tax and budget mega bill. Millions of Americans are expected to lose their health care and food assistance to pay for extending 2017 tax cuts, mostly for the wealthy. Nebraska Republican Mike Flood defended new Medicaid work requirements at a Lincoln town hall.
If you choose not to work, you do not get free health care.
Polls show the bill is deeply unpopular. Flood blames misinformation. With no evidence, Republicans have accused Democrats of paying protesters to disrupt public events. Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes says artificial intelligence has the potential to improve voter outreach. A state chatbot has already engaged in more than 500,000 voting-related conversations, but he warns risks from AI are serious.
We look to the weapons of our enemies and we train against them as much as possible. AI is not a new weapon. It's an amplifier and a magnifier of mis and disinformation.
I'm Catherine Carley.
Despite what you may have seen or heard, bears, bison, and other animals are not leaving Yellowstone in large numbers. Eric Tegedov has the story.
Posts on social media began popping up in July, suggesting that animals might be moving out of the park because they knew more about some impending disaster of which humans were not aware, such as the eruption of the supposed supervolcano lurking under Yellowstone. Michael Poland is the scientist in charge of Yellowstone Volcano Observatory at the U.S. Geological Survey. He says there were undertones in the false claims from these videos that animals know more about nature than humans, but there isn't evidence to support that. He also notes that videos showed animals that were filmed elsewhere or at different times of year, such as a video of mountain lions migrating south.
It was claimed to be in July, and there was snow all over the place, and that's not how Yellowstone looks in July. So I think if people look at these videos and don't take them at face value and think a little bit about what they're seeing, that might help to sort of deduce something that's a joke from something that might be real.
The claims on social media appear to have come from a satirical account, although others believed animals really were leaving the park in droves. Poland wrote an article for the Yellowstone Caldera Chronicles to dispel these rumors. The Chronicles consist of weekly columns written by scientists and collaborators at the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Poland says internet hoaxes like this one happen from time to time and are usually pretty harmless. However, the rumors did have an impact on the staff at Yellowstone National Park.
It hit the national park hard in that they got all kinds of inquiries. So they spent a bunch of their time trying to respond to those inquiries rather than doing other things that might be more constructive.
While fears have persisted that the caldera under Yellowstone will erupt, Poland says that isn't likely.
Reality is that the Yellowstone magma body is mostly solid. We're just not worried about a volcanic eruption there. On human timescales, the bigger hazards are a strong tectonic earthquake, something like the magnitude 7.3 that happened in 1959, a steam explosion like the one that happened just last year.
I'm Eric Tegedov.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 7th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Hannah Francis, and Eric Tegedoff. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm